Hello and welcome to Speak the Words, a Cosmere podcast. I'm Sean.
And I'm Mango.
And this is a podcast where we are slowly but surely making our way through the story of the Cosmere, more specifically the Stormlight Archive, one book at a time. We're working on Oathbringer, currently, the third book in the Stormlight Archive, and we're making some pretty good progress. Mango, do you remember what happened last time?
No.
So last time we had a chapter where Dalinar was in the vision with Yasna and Navani. And one of the things that we got that I just really like is Yasna talking to Dalinar about how people will try to define you by the thing they think least of you about. Right? They try to define her as a heretic and not by any of her accomplishments. Which I really like that conversation. And also, the Stormfather explains what the Fused are, what the Voidbringers, and like what the antagonists of this series are, finally.
The Fused.
Yes, the Fused.
Fused Voidbringers are basically regular singers or listeners who basically get possessed by the souls of the void of the singers from the past, who are very aggressive and vengeful.
They're not doing too great after thousands of years of fighting.
They
talk about how the heralds are broken people. The books are going to kind of touch on this, and they're going to touch on this more and more as we go. But definitely, you should expand if the heralds are broken. And the Fused are doing essentially the same thing. They're probably not great either.
Yeah. Also, we discussed that, like, apparently they said there was something wrong with Eshonai. And, like, she resisted, and so the fusion didn't work the way it was supposed to. If it had worked the way it was supposed to, she might have potentially won that battle with Dalinar.
Which probably would not have been a good thing.
Nope. Well, not for the
Alethi. Not for our protagonists. Dalinar also learned the true story of what happened with the heralds.
Oh yeah.
And
but the Stormfather doesn't want to tell him why the Radiance left, because he said, "Well, then you'll leave too."
Yes.
So no.
Which,
it's like, if it's that bad, then should I be helping you?
What is the secret of the Recreants, Mango? What a question. It's a good question. Why did they lay down their swords? You will find out by the end of this book.
Okay.
We don't know everything about the Recreants still and how it played out, but we know the major reasons why it happened at this point. So you won't have to wait too long for that answer.
Lovely.
We also had a chapter with Shallan, where Yasna and Kaladin butted heads over what to do, because Kaladin is very, you know, I must protect those who cannot protect themselves, and Yasna is like, we need to win this war. We can't afford to be nice and merciful. We have to win.
Yeah, which Kaladin doesn't like that for obvious reasons.
And like, you know, I don't really love it either. I get Yasna's point of view, but at the same time, I'm like,
we can't afford to lose, so being, like, empathetic.
Yeah, yeah.
Being empathetic with the enemy is not helping.
No, it is not. Although, I really love, it's a line they use a lot throughout this book, but I really like when Kaladin is like, you shouldn't use your old wars to justify this war. You should be using this war to rethink your old wars. I like that whole line of thought. And then we also learned the truth about Helleran.
Did we?
Yes, that Helleran was an acolyte of the Skybreakers.
Oh, yeah.
We learned that. We learned that there's still some timeline things about Shallan's backstory that don't really mesh together.
So Shallan shouldn't be too sad about her brother dying, because he wanted to kill Radiant, and potentially if he knew that she was going to be Radiant, he would have killed her.
Yeah, it's not great. It's definitely not great for him.
So, hey, maybe don't be too sad. I know he's your brother and all, but, like, your entire family are terrible people, so. Yeah,
they all really suck.
Literally, her entire family are terrible people.
Yeah. Which, don't forget, the rest of her brothers are still on their way to Yurithiru.
Don't forget, that is still a
thing in the background.
I forgot that was a thing.
Yeah.
Oh, joy.
That will be looming over the rest of this book. I also dropped the bombshell on you that Tien was at least in the beginning of a Spren Bond.
Oh, yeah.
That he was going to be a light weaver. And then the last thing we had was Shallan went to Shallan went as Vale. So Vale went.
He didn't think he was a good person.
Yes. Vale went to go meet with Gaz and the soldiers who seemingly they want to be doing something. There's an overarching theme in Shallan's storylines that Shallan is making people better by her presence. She was actively trying to do that with her family when she was trying to fix her brothers. And in this, it seems like, so the whole thing is Shallan is showing these people a better version of themselves that they could be and making them want to pursue it and step up to it. And so that's part of what the soldiers are doing, is the soldiers have felt good when helping Shallan, like helping Shallan against the Midnight Mother felt good. And now they want to follow that feeling. They want to be better people because of how she pushes them. And so they're eager to get back to doing stuff.
She's making them better, but she's making herself worse.
Yeah, she's not doing great.
She's doing awful.
And then one of the girls that Shallan met earlier in the book, Ishna, popped up. She was spying on Vale, and she had wanted to join the Ghostbloods earlier in the book. And now Vale is saying, hey, I'll let you work with me if you train my soldiers how to be spies. And that is where we left off. This week, we start with chapter 41, On the Ground Looking Up. It has Bridge 4's symbol, and the epigraph reads, regardless, this is not your concern. You turned your back on divinity. If race becomes an issue, he will be dealt with, and so will you.
If race becomes an issue?
Well, they don't care about it right now. He's on Roshar. He's stuck there, too.
He killed Honor.
Yeah, but fucking Honor locked him there first, so who cares? You know, he's not my problem.
Wait, race is just on Roshar, like, always?
He's not on Roshar, he's actually on a different planet in the system, but they've mentioned that he has been locked to this system, that he cannot leave. That was one of the last things that Honor did. So that's why this all matters. Because race doesn't have a fucking choice. He has to get out somehow. He can't just leave and say, whatever, job's done.
Huh.
Yeah. But again,
that's concerning.
Yeah. But again, this epigraph hits on another thing that we already hit on before, which was that Hoyt had a chance to become one of the shards and refused it.
That was another thing that was mentioned.
So like I said, this chapter has the Bridge 4 symbol, and it starts with Teft woke up, unfortunately. His first sensation was pain, old familiar pain. The throbbing behind his eyes, the raw biting needles of his burned fingers, the stiffness of a body that had outlived its usefulness. Had he ever been useful? He rolled over, groaning. No coat. He was in an alleyway between tents and the market. Teft stumbled to his feet and was halfway through relieving himself against some empty boxes before he realized what he was doing. There were no high storms in here to wash the place. Besides, he wasn't some drunkard who wallowed in filth and pissed in alleys, was he? That thought immediately reminded him of the deeper pain. The pain that was with him always. The pain had awakened him. The pain of need. No, he wasn't just some drunkard. He was far, far worse. He stumbled out of the alleyway. Perhaps it was a good thing he'd lost his coat. Storms help him if anyone recognized who he was. He'd shame the entire crew. You're already ashamed of the crew, Teft, and you know it, he thought. You're a godless waste of spit. He fell to his knees before the well and used a small tin cup to scoop out water to drink. His stomach immediately cramped, rejecting it as it always did after a night on the moss. This well seemed deep, rippling water on top and a deep blackness below. He almost threw himself in. If he woke up in Damnation tomorrow, would he still feel that itching need inside? That would be a fitting torment. Voidbringers wouldn't even have to flay his soul. All they'd need to do was tell him he'd never feel sated again, and then they could watch him squirm. Reflected in the waters of the well, a face appeared over his shoulder. A woman with pale white skin, glowing faintly, and hair that hovered around her head like clouds. "You leave me alone," he said. You just go find someone who cares." He stumbled back to his feet. He'd been out all night again. Returning to the barracks would be the smart thing to do. But could he face them like this? He wandered through the market instead. "I'm getting worse," a piece of him realized. The first month in Dalinar's employ, he'd been able to resist for the most part. But he'd had money again after so long as a bridgeman. Having money was dangerous. He'd functioned, only mossing an evening here, an evening there. But then Kaladin had left in this tower where everything had felt so wrong. Those monsters of darkness, including one that had looked just like Teft. He'd needed the moss to deal with that. Who wouldn't? He sighed. When he looked up, he found that Spren standing in front of him. "Teft," she whispered, "you've spoken oaths." Foolish, stupid oaths spoken when he'd hoped that being radiant would remove the cravings. He turned away from her and found his way to a tent nestled among the taverns. He stumbled into the tent where a woman in tight clothing and fingerless gloves brought him a small bowl of fire moss. They knew he wouldn't be able to pay after his binge the night before, but they would get their money eventually. Teft stared at the little bowl, loathing himself, and yet the scent of it made his longing multiply tenfold. He let out a whimpering groan, then seized the fire moss and ground it between his thumb and forefinger. It hurt, of course. He'd worn through his calluses last night and now rubbed the moss with raw, blistering fingers. But this was a sharp, present pain. A good kind of pain. Merely physical. It was a sign of life. It took a minute before he felt the effects, a washing away of his pains, followed by a strengthening of his resolve. He could remember long ago that the fire moss had done more to him. He remembered euphoria, nights spent in a dizzy, wonderful daze, where everything around him seemed to make sense. These days, he needed the moss to feel normal. It wasn't euphoria he craved anymore, it was the mere capacity to keep on going. The moss washed away his burdens, memories of that dark version of himself, memories of turning his family in as heretics even though they'd been right all along. He was a wretch and a coward, and didn't deserve to wear the symbol of Bridge 4. He'd as good as betrayed that Spren already. She'd best have fled. For a moment, he could give that all up to the fire moss. He kept going through bowl after bowl until he pulled his face from the table where he'd built up a puddle of drool. He didn't know how long it had been. "Here he is," Kaladin's voice. A figure knelt beside the table. "Oh, Teft." "He owes us for 3 bowls," said the den's keeper. "1 garnet brome." "Be glad," an accented voice growled. "We do not rip off pieces of your body and pay you with those." Rock was here too. Teft groaned, turning away. "Don't see me," he croaked. "Don't." "Our establishment is perfectly legal, Horneater," the denkeeper said. "If you assault us, be assured we will bring the guard and they will defend us." "Here's your blood money, you eel," Kaladin said. "Rock, can you get him?" Large hands took Teft, surprisingly gentle with their touch. He was crying. "Where's your coat, Teft?" Kaladin asked. "I sold it," Teft admitted. "I sold my own storming coat." Kaladin fell silent, and Teft let Rock carry him from the den. Teft envied better men than he. They didn't have the itch, the one that went so deep that it stung his soul. It was persistent, always with him, and couldn't ever be scratched, despite how hard he tried. Kaladin and Rock set him up in one of the private barrack rooms, wrapped in blankets and with a bowl of rock soup. He apologized, promised to let them know if he felt the need again, that he'd let them help. They were good men, better friends than he deserved. They were all growing into something grand, while Teft just stayed on the ground, looking up. They left him to get some rest. He'd go back to work before the day was out, training bridgemen from the other crews. He could function. He could go for days, pretending that he was normal. Those months running bridges had been the only time in his adult life when he hadn't been dominated by the moss. But even back then, when he'd been able to afford a little alcohol, he'd known that eventually he'd find his way back. The liquor wasn't ever enough. Even as he braced himself to go to work for the next day, or for the day, one nagging thought overshadowed his mind. A shameful thought. "I'm not going to get any more moss for a while, am I?" That sinister knowledge hurt him more than anything. He was going to have to go a few excruciating days feeling like half a man. Days when he couldn't feel anything but his own self-loathing. Days living with the shame, the memories, the glances of other bridgemen. Days without any storming help whatsoever. That terrified him. And that is the end of Teft's chapter.
Oh no.
Teft is an addict. And Sanderson writes addiction very, very well. In a way that is very, very effective. Teft is one of my favorite characters in Stormlight, mostly because of how Sanderson in this book writes his addiction. The next chapter is chapter 42. It is titled Consequences, and it has Dalinar's symbol. And the epigraph reads, Sephandrius, bearer of the first gem, you must know better than to approach us by relying upon presumption of past relationship. And so this is a new shard responding. This is no longer endowment. I can tell you, this shard is called autonomy.
Interesting.
Yes. Dalinar fought in the vision of Ahar Etium. He fired arrows at men that tried to attack a young boy, barely into his teens, that laid on the ground. Prime Akasix Yonagon I, ruler of Aesir, emperor of Greater Makabak. This was the third time that he had experienced this battle, and it had been slightly different each time. Eventually, the Radiant arrived like always and pushed the enemy back. The Emperor finally stumbled to his feet and started down a path away from the cliff. Dalinar followed. They eventually came across a group in the direction that Jasna had explored previously. They gathered around a man who stood on a large boulder. Tall and confident, the man was in his 30s, and he wore white and blue. He had an Alethi feel to him, except not quite. His skin was a shade darker, and something was faintly off about his features. Yet there was something familiar about the man. "You must spread the word," the man proclaimed. "We have won. At long last, the heralds the Voidbringers are defeated. This is not my victory, or that of the other heralds. It is your victory. You have done this. I will lead the charge for the Tranquiline Halls. You will not see me again, but think not on that now. You have won your peace. Revel in it. Rebuild. Go now, help your fellows. Carry with you the light of your herald king's words. We are victorious at long last over evil." This was Ysereze Ilin himself, herald of kings, the greatest among them. Wait, did the king have dark eyes? The group broke up, but the young emperor remained, staring at the place where the herald had stood. Finally, he whispered, Ysereze, king of the heralds. "Yes," Dalinar said, stepping up beside him. "That was him, Your Excellency. My niece visited this vision earlier, and she wrote that she thought she spotted him." Yonagon grabbed Dalinar by the arm. "What did you say? You know me?" "You are Yonagon of Aesir. I am Dalinar Kolin, and I apologize that our meeting must take place under such irregular circumstances." The youth's eyes widened. "I see Aesir himself, and now my enemy? I am not your enemy, and this is no mere dream, Your Excellency. Oh, I know it's not a dream. As I am a prime raised to the throne miraculously, the heralds may choose to speak through me." He looked about. "This day we are living through. It is the day of glory?" "Ahar Etium, yes. Why did they place you here? What does it mean?" "They didn't place me here. Your Excellency, I instigated this vision, and I brought you into it." Skeptical, the boy folded his arms. "Have you been told that I am considered mad? There are rumors. Well, this was my madness. I suffered visions during the storms. Come, see." Dalinar showed Yonagon the large field of the dead. They passed light-eyed and dark, pale skin and dark skin, giant broken stone figures, parchment, even a whole heap of burned and smoking kremlings. We fought together, Yonagon said. "How else could we have resisted? To fight the desolation alone would be madness." Yonagon eyed him. "You wanted to talk to me without the viziers. You wanted me alone. And you can just... you just show me whatever you will strengthen your argument. If you accept that I have the power to show you these visions, would that not in itself imply that you should listen to me? The Alethi are dangerous. Do you know what happened the last time the Alethi were in Aesir? The Sunmaker's rule was a long time ago. The viziers have talked about this. They told me all about it. It started the same way back then, with a warlord uniting the Alethi tribes." "Tribes? You'd compare us to the nomads that roamed to Byla. Alethkar is one of the most cultured kingdoms on Roshar. Your code of law is barely 30 years old." "Your Excellency, I doubt this line of conversation will be relevant. Look around us. Look and see what the desolation will bring." "They say," Yonagon whispered, "that when the Sunmaker rode out of the passes and into Aesir, he had one unexpected problem. He conquered my people too quickly, and didn't know what to do with all his captives. He couldn't leave a fighting population behind him in the towns. There were thousands upon thousands of men he needed to murder. Sometimes he'd simply assign the work to his soldiers. Every man was to kill 30 captives, like a child who had to find an armload of firewood before being allowed to play. In other places, the Sunmaker declared something arbitrary, say that every man with hair beyond a certain length was to be slaughtered. Before he was struck down with disease by the heralds, he murdered 10% of the population of Aesir. They say Zophix was filled with the bones, blown by high storms into piles as tall as the buildings. I am not my ancestor. You revere him. The Alethi all but worship Sadiz. You carry his storming shard blade. I gave that away. I am not my ancestor, but I do share much with him. A youth of brutality, a lifetime spent at war. I have one advantage that he did not. Which is? Dalinar met the young man's eyes. I've lived long enough to see the consequences of what I've done. Yonagon nodded slowly. Yeah, a voice piped up. You're old. Dalinar turned, frowning. That had sounded like a young girl. Why would there be a girl on the battlefield?
Oh,
I didn't expect
no.
you to be so old, the girl said. She sat perched cross-legged on a nearby boulder on a large boulder nearby. And you're really not that black. They call you Blackthorn, but you're really more like dark Tanthorn. Gox is more black than you are, and he's and even he's pretty brownish.
Why is she here?
The young emperor remarkably burst into an enormous grin. Lift, you're back. Not quite back, she said. Got sidetracked, but I'm close now. What happened in your daw, Yonagon said. You barely gave me any kind of explanation. Those people lie about their food. She narrowed her eyes at Dalinar. This is not possible, the Stormfather said. How did she come here? You didn't bring her in? No, this is not possible. How? He's trying to convince me I should trust him, Yonagon said. Don't, she said. He's got too nice a butt. Dalinar cleared his throat. What? Your butt is too nice. Old guys shouldn't have tight butts. It means you spend way too much time swinging a sword or punching people. You should have an old flabby butt. Then I'd trust you. She has a thing about butts, Yonagon said. No, I don't. If someone thinks I'm strange for talking about butts, it's usually because they're jealous. Because I'm the only one without something rammed up mine. She narrowed her eyes at Dalinar, then took the Emperor by the arm. Let's go. Yeah?
Lift.
Yeah. But, Dalinar said, raising his hand. See? You're learning. She grinned at him. Then she and the Emperor vanished. The Stormfather rumbled in frustration. That woman! This is a creation specifically meant to defy my will. Woman, Dalinar asked. That child is tainted by the Night Watcher. Technically, so am I. This is different. This is unnatural. She goes too far. He seemed genuinely upset. In fact, Dalinar was forced to sit and wait until the vision finished. He spent the time staring out over that field of the dead, haunted equally by the future and the past. And that is the end of the chapter. Lift!
Lift, let's go.
Shown up in the book.
Stormfather doesn't like her because apparently she can defy his visions.
Yes.
Because of the Night Watcher. Or is it because of the Night Watcher that she can defy it? Or is it because of her radiant abilities?
It's not her radiant abilities.
Wait, no, it's not her radiant abilities.
Yeah. It is
no,
because
she is slippery and can heal people.
Yes.
That doesn't make sense then. What?
How is this happening? Good question.
Because her boon was to stay the same forever. But what was her curse?
What was it? What is going on with Lift? Great questions. She's one of the back half points of views, or flashbacks. So we won't fucking know. I think she's book six. So we're closer to knowing her backstory than Renarin's, but I care more about Renarin's than Lift's. So I'm like, I'd rather get Renarin book six, but I get it. Book six is supposed to be Lift, so we will learn eventually. That's a long way away. He's going to write all three Mistborn Era 3 books before then, so. And probably two Elantris books, so.
Yeah, we'll
it'll
get
be
back to that in like 10 years.
Yeah. That is a question I do not expect to be answered by the end of the first half, is what the fuck is up with Lift? I expect to be waiting a good amount of time for that answer. But chapter 40.
Me.
Yeah, imagine. Chapter 43 is titled, imagine, I read these books 2 years ago, Mango, so at least I've got 2 years on you of waiting already, so at least you, and we haven't been waiting since 2011 when, or 2010 when Way of Kings started, so, you know. We're lucky to, we're at least waiting less than other people have. Anyways, chapter 43 is titled Spearman, and it has that symbol that I just linked in our general chat.
A ripped patch.
Yes. One of the great things about this book is that so many POV characters showed up and got, we got more symbols for chapters. I think in book four, the general chapter symbol is only used
once. Is this, what's his face?
Is this Moash?
Yeah.
It is, this is Moash POV.
Ah, okay.
The epigraph reads, "You have spoken to one who cannot respond. We instead will take your communication to us, though we know not how you located us upon this world." Moash sat eating some terrible stew while traveling through the Frostlands after fleeing the Shattered Plains, with Graves, who was arguing with another member of the Diagram over where they were. He found himself missing Rock Stew as he sat there. He had slowly lost all his respect for Graves over the course of their traveling. Graves tells him to take the Bridge Forward patch off in case they run into someone from the war camps. It brought memories, facing off against Kaladin, wounded and bleeding. "You will not have him!" He cut the stitches of the patch, still shocked at how he was allowed to carry such a large one, a large dagger now that he was light-eyed. He mused about how it would be much harder to remove the tattoo that he'd gotten, but luckily he had gotten it on his shoulder, not his forehead. He couldn't bring himself to throw away the patch, instead sitting down and thinking of his friends. Were the others sitting around Rock's stewpot somewhere, laughing, joking, betting on how many mugs of ale Lopin could drink, ribbing Kaladin, trying to get him to crack a smile? Moash could almost hear their voices, and he smiled, imagining that he was there. Then he imagined Kaladin telling them what Moash had done. "He tried to kill me," Kaladin would say. "He betrayed everything. His oath to protect the king, his duty to Alethkar, but most importantly, us." Moash sagged, patch in his fingers. He should throw that thing in the fire. He should throw himself in the fire. He looked up toward the sky and saw four Voidbringers descending on their camp. Moash narrowly dodged one of them while another stabbed Graves straight through the chest, then beheaded him.
Oh, well, you don't have to worry about not liking Graves anymore.
No, you don't. The other Diagram members were killed a second later. Kaladin's training took over, and he danced away from the approaching Voidbringer, his shardblade appearing in his hand. This Voidbringer didn't look like the Parshendi he'd seen on the Shattered Plains. This one had a swirling pattern to her skin, red, black, and white. Moash lashed out, driving the Voidbringer away. The Voidbringer tried again to hit him, but was cautious of his shardblade. The weapon still felt too clunky in Moash's hands, too long. He took a long cut up the arm, but managed to avoid getting impaled. One of the other Voidbringers called out that he'd found Graves' shardblade and knocked a spear close to Moash while reaching for it. Moash looked down at his shardblade, the wealth of nations, the most valuable possession a man could own. "Who am I kidding?" he thought. "Who did I ever think I was kidding?" The Voidbringer attacked again, and Moash dismissed his shardblade, instead grabbing the spear. He managed to sweep her legs out and went to run her through with the spear, but she caught herself in the air and hovered instead of collapsing. He quickly blocked her next attack. She surged forward and lashed him upward, but he grabbed onto her shirt and pulled her up slightly with him. He dropped his spear and pulled out his chest as she lashed him again, but he held on and slammed the knife into her chest. She didn't heal as Kaladin would have. Her eyes stopped glowing and the dark light vanished. Moash dropped to the ground. "Bridge four, you bastards," Moash growled. "You can probably kill me, but I'll take one of you with me. At least one." They didn't seem angry that he'd killed their friend. He locked eyes with the woman at the center. "You," she said in accented Alethi, "have passion." One of the others handed her Graves' shardblade. She held it up, inspecting it by the firelight. Then she rose into the air. "You may choose," she said to him. "Die here or accept defeat and give up your weapons." Did they think he'd really trust them? But then, did he really think he could stand against three of them? With a shrug, he tossed aside the spear. He summoned his blade. After all those years dreaming of one of these, he'd finally received one. Kaladin had given it to him. And what good had come of it? He obviously couldn't be trusted with such a weapon. Setting his jaw, Moash pressed his hand to the gemstone and willed the bond to break, back to being a Dark Eyes. He tossed the blade to the ground. One of the Voidbringers took it. Another flew off. A short time later, that one returned with six more. Three attached ropes to the shard plate, then flew off, hauling the heavy armor into the air. Why not lash it? Moash thought for a moment they were actually going to leave him there, but finally two others grabbed him, one arm each, and hauled him into the air. And that is the end of the chapter.
Come on.
I have some more art for you. It is from Navani's notebook. The translations read, the top message is too fanciful, huh? The second message is, ask Rushu how to keep the mast from ripping off. And the bottom message is Yasna's favorite. Oh yeah, that's an interesting little design there, huh?
What?
What is that?
Airships.
Hmm.
They look like ships from Treasure Planet, except obviously the mast was on the top instead of the bottom.
I think it also looks very Final Fantasy-like, which makes sense, because Sanderson is a big Final Fantasy nerd.
So. Is he?
Yeah, he loved 10 a lot. The epigraph reads, we are indeed intrigued, for we thought it was well hidden, insignificant among our many realms. Vale lounged in a tavern with her men, focusing on the people around them. Ishna had come along to teach her men, and Vale could discreetly learn as well. Red is annoyed that they've spent so much time on the spying part, and less time with knives. Ishna says that espionage isn't about stabbing people with knives in alleys. She tells them that they need to learn to blend in. Yeah, well, Gaz is out, Red said. Yeah, Gaz said. It's a curse to be so storming interesting. Vata tells them to shut up and seems actually interested, leaning in to ask Ishna how they're supposed to go unnoticed. She tells them to draw attention to features that they can change instead of ones that they cannot. Red should wear an eye patch that he can remove. Vata should slouch to make his height less noticeable and put on an unusual accent that he can drop. If Gaz pretends to be drunk, nobody will notice his eye patch, just another drunkard. Next, Ishna has them close their eyes and try to recount who was in the room with them. Gaz is only able to recount that there was a woman with a low-cut top and a nice chest, while Red recalls that there's a short, annoying, ugly guy with an eye patch sitting next to him. Vata actually recalls that there were some Sabarial soldiers and that half the tables were occupied. Vale is asked what she was able to remember, and she recalls every single person in the room and what they were doing. Ishna says that Vale is very impressive, but that she missed one person. Vale notices a woman that she hadn't before who was sitting in a corner taking notes on everything going on. Ishna explains that the woman must be an information gatherer for one of the High Princes, probably reporting on the morale of troops. Ishna goes on to teach the men memory tricks and how to pick out relevant information to report. Vale found the techniques fascinating, while Gaz and Red seemed completely overwhelmed. Vata, though, was making progress. It was the first time Vale had seen him approach a task with enthusiasm. She hears Vale hears the market bells and remembers an engagement she was to attend. She leaves the group to keep practicing. Shallan strolled through the hallway beneath Urithiru, pleased with the work that Vale was doing, but wishing that she wouldn't drink so much. She stepped into the former library where Navani, Yasna, Teshiv, and a host of Ardents, scribes, and storm wardens were. She passed by Teshiv's assistant, Janala, who didn't like Shallan on account of the fact that Janala had been courted by Adolin at one point. Shallan found it impossible to try and avoid his exes. Shallan feels extremely overwhelmed by the rest of the people in the room. Some were discussing Azish politics. Navani was talking Fabrials with an engineer. Yes, but how to stabilize it, Brightness? With the sails underneath, it will want to spin over, won't it? I need someone who can handle this, she thought. A scholar. Part of me can become a scholar. Not Vale or Brightness Radiant, but someone... Patterns started humming on her dress again. Shallan back to the wall. No, this was her, wasn't it? Shallan had always wanted to be a scholar, hadn't she? She didn't need another persona to deal with this, right? Right? She finds Yasna and apologizes for being late. Yasna dismisses her until Navani's meeting starts. Pattern reassures her that she belongs among the scholars, though she feels pathetic. She knew what Vale and Radiant wanted, but couldn't figure out what Shallan wanted. Navani called the meeting to order, and everyone took their seats. Shallan noticed Renarin standing in the doorway, peeking in but not entering. Several people turned to stare at him. "Aye," Renarin said. "Father said I could come. Just listen, maybe." "You're more than welcome, cousin," Yasna said. Renarin joined the ring of scholars and fidgeted with the chain that hung from his pocket. Shallan did her best to take notes and not sketch. Navani had the scholars working on trying to understand Urithiru. Inadara explains that she'd been trying to figure out the strange shaping of the rooms and tunnels. She spoke of defensive constructions, ale filtration, and the wells, grouping of rooms that were shaped oddly, and bizarre murals that they'd found of fanciful creatures. Kalami reported that she believed that certain gold and copper metalworks embedded in the walls were fabrials. She also said that they'd been unable to infuse the gemstone pillar, and the only working fabrials were the lifts. Janala says that they should figure out what the tower needs and work back from there instead of figuring out what all the things that don't work do. Navani said. Well, we know that they grew crops outside. Did some of these wall fabrials provide heat? Renarin mumbled something. Everyone in the room looked at him. "What was that, Renarin?" Navani asked. "It's not like that," he said softly. "They're not Fabrials. They're a Fabrial." "Bright Lord," Janala asked, "are you perhaps secretly an Artifabrian, studying engineering by night, reading the women's script?" Several of the others chuckled. Renarin blushed deeply. "You'd never laugh like that at any other man of his rank," Shallan thought, feeling her cheeks grow hot. Renarin always had been a more acceptable target than Dalinar or Adolin. Shallan's anger was a strange sensation. Navani started to say something, but Shallan cut in. "Surely, Janala, you didn't just try to insult the son of the High Prince." "What? No, of course I didn't." "Good," Shallan said, "because if you had been trying to insult him, you did a terrible job. And I've heard that you're very clever, so full of wit and charm and other things." Janala frowned at her. "Is that flattery? We weren't talking of your chest, dear. We're speaking of your mind. Your wonderful, brilliant mind, so keen that it's never been sharpened. So quick it's still running when everyone else is done. So dazzling it's never failed to leave everyone in awe at the things you say. So, Yasna was glaring at her. Shallan held up her notebook. "I took notes." Yasna calls for a short break and pulls Shallan aside. She chastises her on her continued attempts to be mean through wit, and Shallan says that she was just defending Renarin, and Yasna tells her that Navani would have handled it privately. Yasna says that she's bad at teaching wards, and then shoos Shallan away. Renarin appears, surprised that he can see Pattern on Shallan's skirt. She says that Pattern can't turn invisible, and Renarin thanks her for defending him. Shallan says that he was right about the whole place being one big Fabrial. She points out that the Unmade had been able to stretch its tendrils all across Yirithiru, and that the gemstone at the center is tied to everything. "I know my cousin is intimidating," Renarin whispered to her, "but you're a Knight Radiant too, Shallan. Don't forget that. We could stand up to her if we wanted to." "Do we want to?" Renarin grimaced. "Probably not. So often she's right and you just end up feeling like one of the 10 fools." "True, but I don't know if I can stand being ordered around like a child again. I'm starting to feel crazy. What do I do?" Renarin shrugged. "I found the best way to avoid doing what Yasna says is to not be around when she's looking for someone to give orders to." Shallan poked up. That made a lot of sense. Dalinar would need his radiance to go do things, right? She needed to get away. Just until she could figure things out. Go somewhere. Like on that mission to Kolinar? Wouldn't they need someone who could sneak into the palace and activate the device? "Renarin," she said. "You're a genius." He blushed but smiled. The meeting continued, and they continued to discuss Fabrials. Everyone hushed as Dalinar appeared in the doorway.
How many times have people told Renarin that he's a genius?
Well, he is a genius.
At least the second time.
He's a genius.
Yes, he is, but
yes.
I feel like that's at least the second time that they've said it.
Well, Renarin seems to pick up on things about the tower that nobody else does, and you should think about that in the back of your head.
He is a truth watcher, isn't he?
He is. What is going on with Renarin? Renarin sees things. Dalinar appears in the doorway.
He has visions.
He does.
But not the same visions. Different visions. Visions of truth. Whereas Lightweavers are based around lies.
Yes.
So it's interesting that Shallan and he are able to get along when they're, like, opposites.
Yeah, it is interesting. So Dalinar shows up in the doorway and everybody shuts up. "Apologies for my tardiness. Please, don't stop because of me." "Dalinar," Navani asked, "you've never attended a meeting of scribes before." "I just thought I should watch, learn what this piece of my organization is doing." He settled down on a stool outside the ring. They started up again. She'd have thought that Dalinar would know to stay away from meetings like this, where women and scribes... Shallan cocked her head as she saw Renarin glance at his father. Dalinar responded with a raised fist. "He came so Renarin wouldn't feel awkward," Shallan realized. "It can't be improper or feminine for the prince to be here if the Storming Blackthorn decides to attend." She didn't miss the way that Renarin actually raised his eyes to watch the rest of the proceedings. And that is the end of the chapter. And then I have one more really short chapter for us.
Thanks, it's Dalinar. Titled,
yes. I love Dalinar, even though questionable stuff in his past. Very questionable.
Past Dalinar, hate him. Current Dalinar, love him.
Does very good tries to do very good by his sons. He does better by Renarin than he does Adolin.
Yeah. Wait, speaking of, we haven't heard about Adolin in a while.
Yeah, we haven't seen Adolin in a while. You know, as the cast expands, that's going to happen. A lot of people's problem with the next book is that there are some characters that really don't do a lot in it. I'm fine with it because it's characters that do a lot in this book that then have a smaller role in the next one. But there's going to be times where characters kind of slip into the background a little bit.
Where's Pretty Boy Adolin?
I don't know. Chapter 45 is a revelation. It has Moash's symbol. The epigraph reads, "As the waves of the sea must continue to surge, so must our will continue resolute. Alone." The Voidbringers brought Moash to Revelar, a city in central Alethkar. He'd been there many times, working a caravan to Kolinar, but hadn't seen much of the city. Some parchment took him and shoved him toward a pen full of humans. Then they're all moved into a large storm bunker and told not to make trouble or they'll be killed. A man on his own, a man you couldn't control, was dangerous. He was inherently frightening, just because of who he was, and nobody would ever let him in. Except Bridge 4. Well, Bridge 4 had been a special case, and he'd failed that test. Graves had been right to tell him to cut the patch off. This was who he really was. The man everyone looked at with distrust, pulling their children tight and nodding for him to move along. The parchments say that experienced farmers should report for work, as well as workers to carry water into the city and clear debris from the last storm. One of the other men tells Moash that they don't eat unless they work. It shocked Moash to realize that the man was a Light Eyes, and he was still volunteering for slave work. It brightened his day. The parchmen were preparing for work, looking for people to make food, uniforms, and boots. They'd already taken the smiths, fletchers, and armorers. Moash was drawn to the hard labor. They were asking for volunteers to pull the wagons of supplies while the army marched. They'd need to press people into that. He'd like to see Light Eyes made to do it. Moash found a group of caravaneers and asked around until he found a man that he knew. The man was surprised to see Moash and said they'd all given him up for dead. He says that he needs to do familiar work and that he had made him a new man. The man was surprised to find that Moash had been a soldier. He brought Moash to a Bright Lord who questions him on whether aid will be coming soon. They put him in charge, Moash thought, spotting other Light Eyes. They wore fine clothing. There was food aplenty set out at the side of this chamber, while those outside scrounged and did heavy labor. He'd begun to hope, but of course that had been stupid. The arrival of the Voidbringers hadn't cast the Light Eyes down. The few Moash had seen outside were merely the sacrifices. The fawning Dark Eyes at the periphery confirmed this. To damnation with them. They'd been given a chance to escape from the Light Eyes and it only made them more eager to be servants. In that moment, Moash had a revelation. He wasn't broken. All of them were broken. A Lethi society, light-eyed and dark. Maybe all of humankind. Moash didn't say anything and eventually was kicked out. The man that brought him was to be beaten as well. He kicked himself up, dusted himself off, then walked to the third of the workstations, the one seeking hard laborers. There he volunteered for the most difficult job they had, pulling wagons of supplies for the Voidbringer army. And that is the end of the chapter, and where we will stop for tonight. And this is also him kind of being like, maybe the Dark Eyes suck too? Like, Moash, from Moash's point of view, and I don't agree with Moash's point of view entirely, by the way, but from Moash's point of view, he sees the Dark-Eyed people as having, like, the Voidbringers came, and instead of seeking this opportunity to free themselves, the Dark-Eyed people fell even further behind the Light Eyes as, like, protect us. And so Moash is kind of like, well, maybe fuck them too. Maybe fuck all of humanity. Moash is definitely a foil to Kaladin. Honestly, I'm gonna get a lot of flack for this, saying this. Moash is one of my favorite characters. You don't know because we haven't gotten there yet, but I'm gonna get a lot of flack for that. Moash, I think, is one of the most well-written characters in these books.
Not favorite character because good. Favorite character,
I don't love him, but...
Well-written.
Well-written. He's very complicated. And he's not entirely wrong in some places.
You love your complicated characters.
I do. I do love complicated characters. They're my favorite.
This is just Akechi all over.
Yeah. Akechi is a pretty good comparison for Moash. But Moash isn't beloved by any of the fandom like Akechi is by a certain subset of Persona 5.
Well, because Moash isn't pretty.
I don't know. But yes, next time we are going to, if I look at the chapters.
Done?
Yeah, we're done. We're going to have a Yasna point of view next time.
Ooh.
Yes. Thanks guys so much for listening. We'll catch you guys next time. For now, remember we have a Discord server. You guys can join. Link to do so is in the episode description. We have a Twitter account at SpeakStormlight. Email us at speakthewordsasp@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at Sean_AFK. Follow our good friend Alex on Twitter, who made all the juiced cover art, at Alex_BigBoy. That's it. Mango, it is your turn to speak the words. I did make a note of this last time.
Life before death, strength before weakness, journey before destination.